hardly a day goes by in my life, and probably in yours too, that I do not get bombarded either in my mailbox or on the internet through my emails with offers to refinance my house. There are all kinds of schemes and programs and plans out there that you can use, and you have to watch it and be careful, because there are also a lot of bad things out there. But yes, all the, even the legitimate institutions, banks and loan companies, they offer better deals. Ever since the collapse of the economic housing market, especially since 2008, we've even come up with new terminologies, new words. We've never heard before of TARP and HARP, and you really have to be sharp to understand HARP and TARP. Okay, you can listen to the recording and laugh at home. Even the word refinancing has been shrunken down to a shorter version, and now people just talk about refi. You know, you can refi, and I get all these emails. Why don't you refi? Try this company to refi. Well, Jesus tells a story in the Bible about a refinancing situation. There was apparently a bubble. Money was freely available. People were irresponsible. But then the day of reckoning came. Sounds so familiar. It sounds as if Jesus was telling that story right here in our day. And his bank manager, who was flush with the money and loaned out money very easily and frequently, had a problem getting the money back. So this man thought of a plan, and he thought of a refinancing plan, his own TARP and HARP. And so he called all the people who owned money, and he refinanced them. He said, I'll give you a better deal. The man was going to lose his job because the boss was going to lose all his money. But at least under this refinance program, he would get some money back. Maybe it would trickle in slower, but at least something is better than nothing. Sounds like the banks. They're willing to talk to you, and they're willing to cut deals with you. Well, we had that same story, same situation in the Bible. Jesus tells this parable, and that's the background to a scathing rebuke that Jesus makes that made people cringe. Some hated him for that. In Luke chapter 16, where we read the story, in verse 8, Jesus tells the story, and in verse 8, he makes this application. And he says, the master of this bank manager commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. Then Jesus comments, for the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of light. Some translations say the children of this world, or even the children of darkness, are wiser than the children of light. This did not go down well with his audience. They saw themselves as the children of light. How dare Jesus say the children of darkness out there, the world out there, are smarter than the church? You've seen the title of the sermon, When the World Gets It and the Church Doesn't. There are a number of stories and incidents in the Bible where the world seemed to have gotten it, but the church didn't. I think sometimes even the animals get it and people don't. That was a good children's story, Jennifer, and it really illustrated the point of the sermon. when we growl at each other and we show our teeth, so as to speak, at each other, sometimes the animals are more loving and kind and playful than we are. But Jesus used a few examples in his ministry, and he talks to the people and he says, even the people of Sodom and Gomorrah may have had a better chance than the people of his days. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 24, Jesus says, if Sodom and Gomorrah, for that matter, but he only uses the name Sodom, they saw what happened in their day, what the local people saw, then they would have repented. 11 verse 24, but I tell you that it will be more unbearable for Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. Jesus was talking about Capernaum and the cities that heard him preach, but who rejected him. Again, it really irked his audience when Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan. After a Levite and a priest had gone by that wounded man there in the road, and priests and Levites were honored and revered and respected, they were the embodiment of the church. They were respected. People looked up to them. They were leaders in the church. To be a priest and a Levite meant that you had arrived. And Jesus tells the story of the man. In verse 33 of Luke 10, But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. The Samaritan of all people, not the priest, not the Levite. It was the Samaritan who got it, who showed empathy and love and kindness and gentleness. It was the Samaritan whom the people of Israel hated. The Jews would not even want the shadow of a Samaritan to fall upon them. They spat on the ground where a Samaritan had walked. But here the Samaritan got it. And he showed something about the character of God, the care and the love. And the church didn't get it. The world, the Samaritans got it, but somehow the church didn't. And then, of course, a similar story of Samaritans or involving a Samaritan. In Luke chapter 17, we find the 10 lepers, and they were healed, all 10 of them. Verse 15, but one of them, when he saw that he was healed, came back, praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him. What a picture of thankfulness. But then there's a pause. And Jesus says, and he was a Samaritan. Again, it was an ouch moment for the Jews of his time. How dare Jesus even tell a story like this? Ouch. He was a Samaritan. He got it. The church didn't. I want to tell you two real life incidents in my life. And I'm going to separate them. I'm going to tell you one now and then one a little later on. The first one happened long ago and far away. The other one more recent and closer by. The one is a story that shows how the church didn't get it initially. Thank God, finally they came around and they did get it, but initially not. The other one is of how the church really got it from the beginning. The one is somewhat negative. The other one is more positive. The one will be somewhat far removed from you. The other one is closer than you realize right now. The first story happened in South Africa, my home country, where the church was separated along racial lines. We even taught the world a new word. We were the ones who coined the word apartheid, which basically just means separateness. But that was the climate of South Africa for hundreds of years, for that matter, until the late 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, early 90s. I grew up in that culture. The political climate was one of not only segregation, but bitter segregation, hatred, and despising one group of the other. If you were born as a South African, especially a white South African, you were born with prejudice and racism. It was part of your DNA. And so, needless to say, it also unfortunately spilt over into the church. And so we had a very split church. There were racial congregations, there were racial conferences, there were racial unions. And for no other reason than prejudice. Not in order to promote the gospel or anything, but there was a strong prejudice. And when the world kind of woke up and started realizing that this is not good, and when the world around the church said, you know, what we see in the country and what we see in the world and in the church is just not good, it doesn't say much for us in terms of justice and fairness and equality and the dignity of people. When the world was saying that, the church was bunkering in and held on to apartheid. When the world was making overtures and in the political scene, change had come, the church was still holding on. You know, the church is a very conservative, traditional entity. We don't make changes easily or well. It takes a long time to turn this big ship around. We like what we are comfortable with. We like what we are used to. And making changes don't happen quickly or easily for us as human beings. And so it was for the church in South Africa. It was only after we were long lagging behind the world, when they were talking about justice and fairness and equality, and it became, you know, news in the newspapers that the church was behind even society, when it became embarrassing for the church, we started taking a second look. And I'm glad to tell you this morning that finally the church came around. It took a long time. And I was at the time in church administration, and I was part of the process. It was part of one of my happy experiences there to be on those committees that talked to each other and brought about the unification of conferences and the unions we had there, where they are now under one umbrella. But it took a long time to do that. The church was lagging behind the world, far, far behind. But the Lord was gracious to us. We finally came around. When Jesus stood before Pilate, just before his crucifixion, Pilate asks him a question in John chapter 18. And if you know the story, you know that that question is never answered. Verse 33, John 18:33. Pilate then went back inside the palace and he summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And Jesus gave a roundabout answer. He never answered that question. Are you the King of the Jews? But then the next chapter, our scripture reading this morning that little Karenna read so beautifully for us, Pilate comes to his own conclusion. You know, I want us this morning to be a little kinder to Pilate than we normally are. Pilate may have been, in fact he was, a weakling. He didn't have much of a backbone. He couldn't and didn't stand up to the Jews. He caved into the pressure. He was not a brave man. But he was a smart man. He got it. He got it when the church didn't get it. He saw this man before him. And knowing Roman law and knowing anything about the legal process, he saw right through this whole thing. He knew this man was innocent before him. And without consulting anybody, Pilate makes a sign which gets hung up on the cross. And we read in chapter 19, verse 19, Pilate had a notice prepared and he fastened it to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." I'm going to continue verse 20. Many of the Jews read the sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. Pilate got it. Without consulting anybody, he knew this man was the King of the Jews. And to his limited knowledge of spiritual things, Pilate prepared that sign and he wanted to hang it out there for the world to see. Verse 21, and the chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be King of the Jews." You see, Pilate took a big risk. By proclaiming Jesus King of the Jews, he was basically saying the Jews had a king other than Caesar, and Caesar was Pilate's big boss. While Pilate was not so brave when he had to make a decision, he was brave here, and he even took his own future in his own hands and he said, "You know, I'm going to declare this man the King of the Jews." I'm sure Rome would not have liked it when they heard it, but he called Jesus the King of the Jews. I want you to see a picture there. There you have it on the three languages in Aramaic, Greek, and Latin. So remember those that sign. I'm coming back to it. Aramaic, Greek, and Latin. That's the order in which it's or Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. That's the order in which it is there. I can read two of those languages. I can't read the third one. But we'll come back to those signs. By putting up that sign, Pilate makes a legal statement. Pilate says, "I declare this man King of the Jews." It's a statement that has the same connotation as a terminology that we use in our church language and in our Christian vocabulary. You've all heard of the word justification. Pilate is making a statement of justification. Justification is basically God's declaration of our status, despite the reality of our status. God's declaration about our status despite the true reality of our status. Let me give you an example. You drive down the freeway here. The speed limit is 70 miles an hour. You go at 85 miles an hour. The next thing you get pulled over. The police officer gives you a ticket. And you go to court. You did 85 miles an hour. You broke the law. The law says 70 miles. Are you guilty? Of course you are. You have a smart lawyer. He stands there in court. And he comes up with a very beautiful explanation of why this happened. And he impresses the judge, this is your first offense, and you're not an habitual offender, and it was urgent, it was necessary, and, you know, whatever he goes through, but it sits well with the judge, and the judge brings his gavel down and says, case dismissed. And you walk out there a free person. You don't have to pay one penny. You are as free as if you have never committed that offense. Question is, did you break the law? Of course you did. You went 85 miles an hour in a 70-mile zone. But as you walk out the court, do you have to pay a traffic ticket? No, because the judge declared you innocent if you wish, or free, or not guilty, or at least not having to pay the penalty for your guilt. Pilate, and the reason why you are free, even though you're not really innocent, you are guilty, but the only reason why you are now not guilty, in quotes, is because the judge said so. And Pilate says, this is the king of the Jews because I say so. In verse 22 of that same chapter, Pilate gets so upset with them that when they come and remonstrate it, he says, look, I don't want to have any further discussion about it. What I have written, I have written. He brings the gavel down like in a courtroom, and he makes this justification statement, if you please. Even this non-Jewish, non-religious person outside got it when the church of the time didn't. When they wanted to crucify Jesus, when they hated him, when they didn't recognize him as the Son of God, when they didn't see who he was, Pilate, the Roman, saw it. And Pilate said, what I have written, I have written for the whole world to see. In Mark 15, verse 39, there was a centurion posted there to watch Jesus. This hardened Roman soldier stood there and saw everything that happened that we read in the Bible of. He saw that veil being torn in two and how Jesus died. And he said these very well-known words, surely, surely, this man was the Son of God. Even the Roman soldier got it. When the church spat on him and the church mocked him, the Roman soldier got it. Surely this man was the Son of God. I want to come back to those three languages that we saw on that sign. Pilate, smart man that he was, maybe even inspired, unbeknownst to him himself, wrote those words in three languages. The Bible said Aramaic, you remember the other two? Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. Aramaic was the language, the lingua franca, or the everyday language of the people, especially in the northern region of Israel, all those little towns around the Sea of Galilee, places like Capernaum, Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, those were Aramaic-speaking communities. Down in Jerusalem, they spoke good, proper English. I mean, proper Jewish, proper Hebrew. The King's English. But up in Galilee, they spoke Aramaic. It was the everyday language. When Jesus was in Jerusalem, he could speak proper Hebrew to them. But when he was up in his home area where he grew up, he spoke to the people in a way that they could understand. Makes me think of that statement in the book Desire of Ages, where the author says that Jesus mingled with people as one desiring their good. He was there in their streets. He healed them. He fed them. He mingled with them. And then, only after then, he bade them follow me. The Aramaic language is interesting, and we still have, even in our English Bible, some Aramaic words. And I want to share a few with you just for interest. We still find them. They were just transliterated. They were not translated, but transliterated. So they just used the same words in the English language. When Jesus healed the little girl of Jairus, he says, "Talitha, Talitha kumi," little girl, get up. That was Aramaic. When he healed the deaf man, he put his fingers in his ears and he said, "Ephata." That's Aramaic, open up, speaking to his ears. When Jesus prayed, "Abba, Father," Abba is an Aramaic word. When Jesus says, "You'll either worship God or Mammon," he used Aramaic. When Mary met Jesus on the resurrection morning there in the garden and first thought that he was the gardener, and she recognized him, she said, "Rabboni." That was Aramaic. The expression "Maranatha," this well wish of grace and peace, "Maranatha," is an Aramaic word. When Jesus hung on the cross, "Eli, Eli, sabachthani," he called out. He spoke Aramaic. When Jesus says, "Every jot and tittle of the law," those were Aramaic expressions. What about some common names? Every time you see the name in the New Testament, bar somebody, the word B-A-R, you know it's Aramaic. Bar means the son of. So Peter was called Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah. Bartholomew, Barabbas, interesting name. Barabbas, the guy whose place Jesus took on the cross. Are two Aramaic words put together. I've already used both of them. Bar and Abba. Bar Abba. Son of a father. Now that's kind of duh. We're all sons of a father. But maybe because he was such a vicious criminal, they didn't even want to call him after his dad. His nickname became just son of somebody. Barabbas, son of a father. He's somebody's child. We don't even want to know. We don't care. In the New Testament, when they were choosing a new disciple to replace Judas, remember they had two names. There was Matthias, who eventually became the new disciple. But there was another contender. They had to kind of cast lots between two names. The other name was Barsabbas. Or Bar Sabbas. Bar, son of the Sabbath. In Acts chapter 1. His other name was Justice. And I'm wondering why Matthias was chosen and not Bar Sabbas. Barsabbas. He is the son of the Sabbath and Justice. Maybe he was a very legalistic guy. And the church didn't want him. You know, legalism is always bad for the church. Why was he called son of the Sabbath? Maybe he was a great defender of the Sabbath. Maybe a great proponent of the Sabbath. And Justice, he was out there for him. It was black and white and the law. And maybe they thought he was not good news for the church at the time. Finally, we have two little children in our church. I don't think they are here this morning. But we have a little brother and sister. And they both have Aramaic names, Thomas and Tabitha. Thomas and Tabitha are two Aramaic names. So Thomas and Tabitha, where are you? Are you here? Wave at me. If you are, just wave your hand. Okay, you're not here. But those are the Asri children in our church, and they have these Aramaic names. Places like Gethsemane and Golgotha are Aramaic names. Gethsemane, interesting, is the press or the place where the olive is pressed or parsed. The place of the press. Jesus was pressed and parsed in Calvary and on Golgotha. So those are a few interesting things about the Aramaic language. And Jesus used it to communicate with the everyday people. But then it was also written in Latin. Latin was the language of the courtroom. Even today, Latin is very much part of the legal system. It was the language of writers. Great epic pieces were written in Latin. It was the language of the educated. If you were educated, you knew Latin. I took Latin in high school, so I'm halfway educated. But yeah, that was the language of the courtroom. It was the even the church accepted Latin. Now, there was classical Latin, and there was the vulgar Latin. It was like the everyday Latin, but it was still Latin. And the Roman Catholic Bible today is called the Vulgate version. It is the Vulgate Latin that was used in that Bible. It's still the official Bible of the Roman Catholic Church. And then it was written in Greek. Greek was the language of the theater. It was the language of the hearts. It was the language of art and sophistication. When Latin appealed to the mind, Greek appealed to the heart. And so Pilate declares to the world that Jesus is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He's the King of the Jews. And he puts it up in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. If you know anything about the personality temperaments, he's appealing to every kind of personality and temperament that's out there. The choleric Latin people, the melancholic and phlegmatic Greek people, just everybody out there, the left brain people, the right brain people, those who need facts and those who just need to have a good feeling. But it speaks to everybody. It speaks to everybody. I told you that I have two stories to share with you from my own experience. The one was many years ago in South Africa when the church lagged behind. The other one is more recent and much, much closer home. As we are worshiping here in this church this morning, across the patio, there's another group meeting, our Cross Connection Church, and they go there because they have a different format, they have a different style, they sing different hymns or songs, they have different musical instruments, and they enjoy their worship. When we started, and it was last week, just 7 months ago, they started on September 15, so 7 months ago they started. And whereas my first story, I'm kind of ashamed to tell that story because of how the church lagged behind. This second story, I'm proud to tell because you are part of that story. When I brought that request to our church board and to the elders, not knowing what your reaction would be, because they don't have an organ there, they have drums. They don't sing hymns, they sing praise music. And I didn't know how that would sit with you. But you folk got it. You folk, the Yucaipa Church, got it. And you said, and you saw what they were trying to do and what we were trying to do. We said, let's try and see if we can get people back to church who are not coming to church. Let's see if we can appeal to other people who've never been to church. And that happened, and that is happening. It's still kind of in its baby steps. It's only 7 months, as I said. But there are people, as we're sitting here and have been sitting here for the past 40, 50 years, there are people who are there, sitting there this morning for the first or the second time, new people, people who haven't darkened the church door in years and years. And God is blessing. But you as a church took that risk. The big question is not, should we do things like that or shouldn't we? The big question is really, how far are we willing to go if it is going to save a life for the kingdom? And it's a question we always have to ask. Now, don't misunderstand me. Don't get frightened. Don't get antsy. Don't get jittery. This is not a plea to bring the drums into the sanctuary. I know as the drums come in the back door, some of you will walk out the front door. And that's fine, and I told that group, if you like drum music, you go there. If you like organ music, you come here. And that should settle it. So this is not a plea for that. But what I'm saying is, let me ask you the question. Let me ask you this question. If you know, if you would know for sure that bringing drums into the church would save one person for the kingdom, would you let them in or not? Don't answer me now, but that's a question you need to kind of ask yourself. Again, I say this is not a plea to do that. I have no intention of doing that. But what I'm saying is, sometimes people outside these four walls have a perspective that we sometimes don't get. And we don't always see how we can be successful in reaching people for God's kingdom. But to your honor and to your credit, you did in this instance, in this case, you did. And I think God is blessing, and we see people practically being saved and coming to church who haven't been to church. Just yesterday, I got two emails. The people who sent me the emails did not know that I was going to preach the sermon this morning, but they did give me some material for my sermon. The one email was from Steve Darmody. You all know Steve Darmody, the Christian artist, musician. You've probably also read and heard that the General Conference is planning a major, massive outreach to the city of New York next year. They're already busy with it. So there's a lot of seed sowing going on in the city of New York right now. And then 2014, there'll be a very concerted effort to reach the people of the Big Apple with the gospel of Christ, with a three angels message. And so Steve Darmody sent out this email saying that in February of 2014, the Adventists are taking over Carnegie Hall with a big highbrow concert. You know, only the people who can speak Latin go to Carnegie Hall, and the people who can afford it. Common people like myself don't go to Carnegie Hall. But it's a prestigious place, as you know. Not everybody can perform in Carnegie Hall. If you can write in your resume that you have performed in Carnegie Hall, you are a made person. The Adventist Church is putting on a big, big international conference. So this email was asking all musicians from around the world, the top of the best, to come and register and be part of that musical concert. I hope we'll be able to see it on television. That's probably as close as I will ever get to Carnegie Hall. But here, our church, I think, is getting it. We're reaching out to a type of person that we will never, never reach with any other method. The highbrow, black bow tie, long evening dress people who go to these extravagant events, who go to Carnegie Hall. will have an opportunity in February to listen to an Adventist musical concert in Carnegie Hall. At the same time, I got another email from my friend, Pastor Bill. As you know, Bill is a biker, and some of you sitting here are part of Bill's biking club or biking association. Many of you go on a Sunday morning or on a nice day, you go on a ride, and you're all part of this motorcycle ministry called Three Angels Messengers Motorcycle Ministry. It's reaching a totally different group of people. It's reaching the leather jackets, boot-wearing, bicycle, motorbike fans. You know what they look like. They have the Hell's Angels appearance. Not that they are. But they're reaching out, and they are successful in reaching people, as they call it, a ministry behind bars. A ministry behind bars, the handlebars. Two totally different emails appealing to two totally different groups of people. The question that I want to leave with you this morning is, how vulnerable are you willing to get? How creative are you willing to get? How out of the box are you willing to think? How daring are you willing to be to reach somebody for Christ? Because out there in the world are the Aramaic-speaking people, the commoners. There are the Latin-speaking people, the sophisticated people. There are the Greek-speaking people. The educated, the uneducated. The sophisticated, the unsophisticated. The blue collar, the white collar. They're all out there. And we have the gospel of Jesus Christ to take to them. And we need to take it to them in a language, whether it's Greek or Hebrew or Latin or Aramaic, or whatever it is, and I'm not speaking about real languages, as you know. Whatever we can do to save a person, we need to be willing. Let's not be like the church in Jesus' time that doesn't get it when the rest of the world gets it. When the rest of the world knows how to reach people with technology and in all kinds of means, in advertising, we as a church need to capitalize on that knowledge and reach people for Christ. How willing are you? Christ to the world we bring. Christ to the world we sing. The world to Christ we bring. Those are the words of our closing hymn. Let us, like Pilate, put it out there in whatever language so that somebody who walks past, when you see the cross of Christ, when people are confronted with the cross of Christ, will they read a message that's a language that speaks to their ears and to their hearts? As you looked at the cross, Christ to the world we bring, the world to Christ we bring. May God bless you as you are willing to share this gospel in whatever form, in whatever medium, in whatever way. Some of you are smart on the internet. Some of you know how to do the texting with your thumbs. Use whatever method you can, but share Christ, because somebody out there, some Aramaic, some Roman, some Latin speaking, some Greek, needs to hear the message. God bless you.